Hello and welcome to Before Our Friends Die. You're joined by me, Kavan, and this is the Aki and Saltfish Digital Network. Today, I'm joined by a very special guest. This is a conversation I've been wanting to have for a long time. Dr. Katie Adisako, and she is the founder of Positive Psychology for Life. And today, we're going to touch on a very, very important topic, grief. This show is called Before Our Friends Die, and if you didn't know, the reason we made this show is because Rochelle and I, when we first started this network, one of our friends sadly passed away, and we wanted to make sure that we had a mechanism to capture the stories that we had, that they would have had, that all of our networks have before our friends die. This is about urgent conversations, phone conversations, and things that we feel are important. And to be honest, I don't know of a more important conversation than learning how to navigate grief. So I'm joined by a very, very special guest. Thank you so much, Katie, for joining me. And this is a super important episode. I was saying, you know, before we got on air, that this is potentially our flagship episode. This is the episode I've been wanting to do right from the get-go. So thank you so much. And let's get stuck in. Grief is weird, right?
Just about.
Grief is very, very weird. I mean, the aim of this particular episode is to, I suppose, get the audience and ourselves a little bit more comfortable, familiar with the concept of grief. I still can't get my head around it, but you're a psychologist. Yeah?
I am. Yeah.
And I'd like to understand more about how grief functions or makes us function both socially and psychologically. So what does grief do to us psychologically? What sort of background can you give us on grief?
Okay, wow, load of question, but let's get into it. okay, so I guess you can't have one without the other, right? We can't have life without death, just to put it out there. But it is, grief itself is a very, very complex and deeply personal experience, I suppose, right? So it varies widely among individuals, but it also has some universal aspects that can be understood both, I guess, psychologically and socially, because we're all humans. So I guess where we all have common ground, there are some similarities. And yet, because we're all so unique and so different, it's also very, very complex and very different and a very personal experience. So it means a lot of different things socially and psychologically. I mean, would you like to like dive into it, like anything in particular?
Yeah, so you know, one of the things I hear about when I hear people talk about grief, and I think throughout the episode I'll reference, the only way I know grief is by either seeing it or hearing about it, yeah? And obviously I feel it as well, but I can't process it the way I feel it. I mirror other people's emotions, if you will, in that respect. What I've heard about in the discussions around grief is the five stages of grief. I think anger is one, you know, rejection of the idea. Talk us through those five stages of grief, if you can, please.
Okay, yeah, sure. So, so Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, she wrote, I think it was 1969 or in the 60s, she wrote this groundbreaking book about these stages. And the different stages, so the stages include denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and acceptance. Now, these stages, when the book came out, and obviously since then, luckily, there's been a lot of research since and more developments. But one key thing, I think, to say when you talk about a model like this or the framework is that it's not linear or uniform for everyone. OK, so some people may not experience all stages, or they may experience them in different order as well. So it's important to understand that these stages are more descriptive rather than prescriptive. So offering a framework helps for us, because we, as human beings, like you said earlier on, I love what you said about feeling. It's something you can't put your hand on, right? It's something you feel. So it's the same with grief. It's so important to understand that we need things as human beings to make sense of it, so that cognitively we understand what it's actually that we're going through. So I guess frameworks like this really help, because we can name it. If you name your feelings, then you get, I guess, a little bit more in control rather than being consumed by the feelings. So these stages are really important, but they're not linear. And like I said, everybody goes through them in very different stages in their own times. And since then, there's been, so a few years after she brought out her book, she teamed up with David Kessler, who is a very well-known grief expert as well. And he added the sixth stage, which is finding meaning. So, I mean, we could look at it a little bit practically just to make a little bit more sense to the listener. So imagine someone has lost a close family member, right? So initially, they might refuse to believe the news. That's denial, right? They may act as nothing has happened, insisting that there must be some kind of a mistake. And this denial is a defense mechanism, right? So we are always out to survive. So it is our way of defending against that buffer, the immediate shock, allowing us to process the loss at our own pace, I suppose. So that's denial. Then you have anger, right? So as the reality of the loss sets in, you might become more frustrated and angry, right? And this anger can be directed towards others sometimes, towards yourself, or even the person that you've lost. So you might ask questions about fairness, right? Like, why me? Why them? And it can be a way to kind of mask the pain of the loss. And it provides temporary structure as well to the overwhelming feelings of grief, I suppose, because every emotion has its function. So even anger, although it doesn't feel comfortable, it's protecting us, right? It's a boundary that has been crossed. So, and then we have bargaining, for example. Again, they're not linear, so I'm just going through them, just the different stages in general. But bargaining, that's a stage where the grieving person might start to think about what they could have done differently to prevent the loss. So there might be a lot of if only or what if statements that go through your head. If only I called them more often, if only I could have been there. And that often is accompanied by guilt, which is not a really nice feeling either, right? So we don't shame, guilt, all of these kind of feelings, they just don't feel comfortable. And again, survival mode, we try to suppress those kind of feelings that don't feel comfortable. Actually, by doing that, they don't necessarily go away. So, but we get to that, I suppose, with the coping and stuff. But the bargaining stage is about negotiating internally. So sometimes, even with higher powers or whatever the person believes in, right? If you're religious or spiritual, but it kind of provides a way out of the pain. So then you've got depression. So again, as a reality kind of becomes a bit more real, I suppose, of the loss, and that fully sets in, you might enter this deep sadness. Okay, so this is not a sign of mental illness or anything like that, but it's a natural response to grief. So that might cause you to withdraw from social activities, isolate yourself, feel hopeless to some extent, and experience a deep sense, I guess, of emptiness as well. So it's that kind of period of coming to terms with the extent of the loss as well. And sometimes there is, I guess, everybody feels, we're naturally all, as human beings, we can naturally process grief, okay? But again, like I said in the beginning, it varies from person to person. So I guess even your first question, yes, humans are inherently capable of processing grief, both it's a process and a state, but the capacity to do so varies. So your coping mechanisms and, you know, the support system you have. But sorry, back to the stages. Where were we? So we had denial, anger, bargaining, depression, and then acceptance, right? Okay, so finally, the grieving person may reach a point of acceptance. So it's important to note here again that acceptance doesn't mean that you're okay with it, that by any means you're over it and you've kind of, you're happy now or whatever. Like, no, it doesn't. It just means that rather you now in a position where you can acknowledge the reality of the situation and begin to adjust your life without the person that you've lost, without the loved one. So you might start to plan for the future now and engage in activities again that you had put aside for a while. So those are the five stages from Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. And then, like I said, the sixth stage that then was evolved from David Kessler was meaning. So then you kind of start finding meaning in your grief. So it's about searching for a deeper understanding of the purpose, I guess, or lessons that can be drawn from the experience. Again, doesn't mean that you're looking for meaning in the death, because that's just horrible facts. Like, you can't change anything about that. But it means that you're now able to see beyond it, what it meant to have that person in your life. And that ultimately helps to kind of carry on. So it's a lot to take in, but yeah, does that all make sense?
This is fascinating, because I think one of the things I was looking for out of this episode was you said that, you know, we can process grief. And I think one of the things that, I don't know, maybe I'll speak for myself, rather, I don't, you know, obviously I haven't done a survey of society, but one of the things that I certainly feel like is it just must be almost impossible to process the fact that you've lost someone who was here. Like, what does that even mean? That is crazy. But then when you're talking through the stages and you're talking through the process, I can sort of identify with them at different points in different, you know, different people, you know, grieving different people and different things, I could see, okay, yeah, that was a really sort of angry moment, but that was actually a bargaining moment. And one of the things, I had a chat with my barber a couple of weeks ago, and I mentioned to him that I was having this conversation about grief. And he says, what are you looking to get out of this conversation? Or like, should we practice it now? I says, I don't really tend to answer the questions. I tend to ask them. I says just in case, you know, he started trying to ask some typical questions. But one thing that came out of it was he knew someone who they had a sort of negative relationship with someone who was close to them, but they were alive. But he'd had conversations with them about their sort of almost pre-bargaining that if that person does pass away, they might feel regret and they might bargain with themselves. And they were sort of balancing up. He was talking his friend through balancing up whether he should engage in that relationship now or whether he should sort of deal with the bargaining later. And it was a really, really fascinating thing, because I think we do have more conversations with ourselves about grief and about relationships and about what it might mean if this person was to pass away than we perhaps admit publicly. But those are very, very real conversations. And actually, that acceptance phase, and particularly that meaning phase, are really, really important. Because every funeral I've been to, I've left obviously feeling very sad, but also feeling like, okay, I need to do this differently. I need to, you know, have more relationships with so-and-so. I need to spend more time on the things I enjoy. You know, those sort of sentiments. But they go pretty quickly. Because, what is it about humans that means, while we process it, we also move on, not move on from the death, but we move on from the meaning phase? Because I feel like meaning can be very, very, what's the word I'm looking for? Fleeting. Meaning can be fleeting.
Yeah, sure. And it might change, right? Like what gives you purpose now, or the lessons that can be drawn from one thing might be very different from a different experience, or what matters to you now, the goals you have in your life now might be different in 5 years' time. So I think it's just about being in tune with yourself, right? And even the things you were saying about your conversation with your friend, in a way, it's nice to have those things, because I think in Western cultures sometimes as well, we don't talk about death, we don't talk about grief. It's such a taboo topic, but it's a part of life, right? Like, you can't have light without darkness, you can't have life without death, like I said in the beginning. So I think as human beings, the more we talk and normalize these things that go on with us in us as well, the better we can live and the more fulfilled we can live, right? Yeah. So even the friend, when he was bargaining, like, shall I, and would I have regrets? Well, if you think that pain would be quite unbearable, then yeah, make amends, right? Like, try and recognize that relationship obviously means something to you, right? But if that's not the case, if you think, well, really, they're not, you know, I'm not gaining anything from that person in my life, or vice versa, then okay, there may be some relations that are not for you. So I think it's just really important to be honest with yourself. And some, you know, we grow up traditionally, culturally, always thinking, don't talk about anything that's uncomfortable. Somebody cries, don't cry. Off you, you know, up you get, you're fine. And it's like, who are we to judge, right? Like, I mean, even grief and losses, like, we went through a pandemic, teenagers, they were grieving not being able to go to school and seeing their friends. So, and some people are like, oh my God, people have lost people. What are you talking about? Your grief can't be bad. But that is their loss. Everybody experiences things differently. And the thing with grief is that everybody thinks their loss is the hardest. And I think when you then come to judge or make these things, these judgments, it's actually something I listened to a different podcast between Brené Brown and I think it was David Kessler, actually. And he was talking about how judgment demands punishment, right? So right. And I love, just stuck with me, because when you judge somebody on how they grieve or anything really in life, right? Whatever your relationship with them, when you judge them, you're actually punishing yourself psychologically and the person. So it was just I'm kind of drifting away. But what I'm trying to say is, it's very important to kind of be in tune with our thought processes and our feelings, because they all affect one another, right? Thoughts, feelings, behavior.
There are a few things I want to pick up on that. If one of the first stages or one of the stages is denial, and like you say, we've been socialized from really early to sort of, you know, you're not in pain, get up, you know, those sorts of messages. How can you be in tune with your emotions? Because you've been programmed to deny them.
Of course, yeah. Well, the beautiful thing about human beings, and that's something some people might not be aware of it, but the beautiful thing is that our brain, our synapses, right? Like the things we expose ourselves to, teach us, help us grow, help us change. We are not in a fixed state. We're very fluid people. So when I talk about mental health sometimes, that's exactly what I say. We've got, about 7.5 billion people in the world, nearly eight, however, we're a lot of people, mm-hmm. right? The population is massive. And when you ask people who has got mental health, people might say, I don't know, a few billions, a few millions. No, we all have mental health because we're all humans. So we all have feelings. We all have thoughts. We all live. It might all be different, right? Like, you might process certain things or even these stages that we talked about very differently to me. It's based on the way that you were brought up, the experience you made, the schemas that you've built across your life. But the beautiful thing is that our brain, whatever we stimulate our brain with, it's still able to make new pathways, to create new pathways, which means we're not in a fixed state. As long as we think we're in a fixed state, of course we'll be there.
Yeah.
But if we realize that actually, no, our mindset can grow, we can learn, we can improve, we can live differently, it's mind-blowing. Like, you can literally break those schemas. And it's a process. Like, we just need to be patient. There are so many different psychological concepts that are important here, right? You have self-compassion. You need to know it's a process and all of those things. So we probably would need different episodes.
Yeah, part two. Something I want to pick up on is you mentioned around kids and schools, particularly during the pandemic, and sort of grieving those sort of social interactions. Listeners may feel like grief is something that only happens when somebody passes away. But I want you to open that box a little bit more, if you can, and tell us more about what else grief can be.
Absolutely. It can absolutely extend beyond the death of a loved one, right? Like, it's almost like that's the first thing we think about when we think of grief. But people can grieve over the loss of anything that was significant to them, right? That can be your job, that can be a relationship, that can be a cherished possession even. Doesn't mean you are materialistic. It's just something that, was holding very close meaning to you, right? Significant life changes, moving, any unfulfilled goals, jobs and dreams, like any of those things that are important to you, that matter to you as a person, the emotional impact of these losses can be as profound as grieving for a person. And they all require a similar process of adaptation and healing. Right. So when you lose a job, for example, you may experience grief because it's not just a source of income, but often a part of your identity and your routine. So you may grieve the loss of stability, purpose, any social connections that you had through the job. Right. Breakups or divorces can result in profound grief. You're not just losing a partner, but also the dreams and future plans that you had together. Right. As well as the kind of emotional connection that you shared, the memories. Again, like major life transitions, like I was saying, moving or a new place, retiring or becoming an empty nester, right?
Yeah.
Your children moving out, that can bring feelings of grief. These changes just kind of disrupt your familiar routine and require adjustment. Human beings usually don't like change or uncertainty. So anything that rocks you and has deep personal meaning and that's taken away from you is grieving.
Wow. And particularly with things like the empty nest syndrome and so on and so forth, they can have physical sort of manifestations as well, right? So when we talk about those five stages, a lot of them may be perceived by the listeners as sort of inside your mind, but actually they can have physical manifestations. Talk us through, if you can, some of the manifestations that may look like on the outside when someone's going through those processes or just generally going through grief.
Right. Okay, so When you go through grief, it can trigger a range of psychological, physiological, and different like cognitive, behavioral, and psychological responses. So it changes your brain chemistry. Okay, so grieving individuals show increased activity in brain regions that are responsible for amygdala, right? So let's say sadness, longing, fear, rumination, and even physical pain. So long-term grief, for example, can lead to greater cognitive decline, right? So you might not remember things really well, or it affects areas in your brain that are responsible for the way you regulate your emotions, the way you remember things, your attachment to people. It can result in physical symptoms like loss of appetite, sleep difficulties. You might not be able to sleep or rest. Reduced immune function as well. So darling, just on the podcast.
Hi, Mummy.
Sorry.
That's all right. That's fine.
George. So I'm so sorry. sorry, what were we talking about?
The physical manifestations of grief.
Yeah, so the physical. So again, yeah, you might not, and depending how close the person was to you as well, you might just, you know, you might not want, you can't function as you usually would. You might skip meals. You, like I said, you can't really shut off and sleep. You might be scared of sleeping. Different things, but yeah, it can have those kind of physical effects, and all of those things as well. You can feel stressed because it might have such a large impact now on your life and how your life might change, the worries that you might have from that, that all affects the immune system, right? So you can be more susceptible to colds and other things that can physically obviously have an impact on you. We talked about poor memory, emotional things, you know, guilt, anger, feelings of isolation. So it does affect you on all different levels, and it can be really uncomfortable again, right? So
Katie, do you know what, and maybe you can correct me on this, but do you know what's really striking to me after hearing you say those things? I think 90% of those, I've just had, I think maybe like two or three new babies in the family and my friendship groups in the last like 10 days. So, you know, I've been visiting a lot of newborns, been visiting a lot of parents, been trying to offer like care packages with food and things that will help them sleep. You know, just all those little things that I think are actually quite major, because if you just had a baby, you're not going to be cooking 3-course meals, are you? You're not going to be getting the right sleep. So you want to be doing all those things that are going to nourish you as quickly as possible, as efficiently as possible. Cool. 90% of the things you just mentioned.
I'm lucky to have you.
Yeah, I guess so. 90% of the things you've just mentioned also ring true for new life. The physical effects that it has on the body, you know, lack of sleep, decision making, memory, appetite suppression, you know, nerves, anxiety, all those things creep in as well as a new parent. I imagine, I'm not a parent, but I imagine seeing it happen in others. So it's very, like, that circle of life is very, very fascinating. It's evident in those two descriptions of both grief, but also, you know, focus on a new being now.
Yeah.
Wild.
Absolutely. And I think it's beautiful that you said it that way, because I think it just highlights the connection between mind and body as well, right? Like different circumstances will have an impact on you physically and psychologically, because our bodies and mind are connected. So they have an impact on each other. And yeah, those are really life-changing situations, aren't they? Like a new baby completely changes dynamics, your routine, and equally losing somebody. So
one of the things that I like to do with Before Our Friends Die podcast is, you know, we're talking about things that are really urgent. We're talking about things that are really important. And often those things come with a call to action and a call to change. So when I think socially about how we navigate grief as human beings, you know, human beings with jobs, human beings with dependents, human beings with responsibilities, actually, a lot of the society we live in doesn't allow for fluid grief. Doesn't allow for grief to take more than, dare I say, 2 days. Some organisations I know have 2 days bereavement leave. That, I'm going to go out on a limb and say that's not enough psychologically, but socially we're forced to almost get over it. And I say that in quotes if you're not watching me do that.
Yeah.
So, you know, what are your thoughts on that? What is the ideal way that society can adapt to genuine grief? Blue sky thinking.
Well, if we actually evolve, right, and if we just acknowledge the fact that we have moved a long way from our ancestors, right, it's no longer just about survival, it's actually about thriving and living a fulfilled life. We need to acknowledge the fact that we're human beings and we have feelings, and these are all parts of it, and we're all very unique. Obviously, as a business, you need to function as an organization. So I understand you need your people, but the problem is, if your employees are not well enough, if their well-being is at stake because, for example, they've just lost somebody really close and they're going through grief, you're not going to get the best out of them anyway. So the best thing an organization can do is to actually acknowledge them as a human being and tried to make the necessary arrangements to still be able to function as an organization, but also support and show the employee that they care, right? They're seen, they're valued, they're heard. We're here for you. You're going through this. We are humans. We're not robots. So bereavement policies often fall short, of providing adequate time for grieving processing. And that's often because, again, our social norms around grief often don't align with the psychological reality of it. So 2 days of bereavement is, of course, not sufficient, right, for someone to process their grief. And also, if we go back to the stages and the uniqueness of the experience of grieving, you might have acceptance right after the funeral, and then you might feel really, really deep depression 2 days after or on their first birthday or first anniversary. So, like I said, you feel the different stage at different times, and it doesn't mean the other stages don't come back. So it's a lifelong process, because the person that you've lost is always going to be lost now. So that you know, like, you're not going to miss them any less. You just learn to live with it. So I guess at some point, you have to go back to normality, and that acceptance need to kind of show by you functioning in ways again, because otherwise, obviously, you can't live. It's not sustainable. However, as organization, I think we need to support about that. 2 days definitely is not enough. I don't know what the ideal is, but I think you just have to check in on your employees, right? Like, and make sure they're okay, make sure the right resources and supports are in place. But as a society, I think I just like to say that we want quick resolutions of everything. We're such an on-demand generation, right? Like, we want something, there's an instant gratification. So, and it's almost like the same, I would like to say that, unfortunately, we take the same stance when it comes to feelings. But it's a process, and it takes time, and it can involve a range of emotions and behaviors. And our traditional and sometimes cultural ways of not wanting to sit with anything because it's uncomfortable, it's just not healthy. So, there's a lot of work to be done. Skyline thinking is that we acknowledge this and accept this and are less judgmental of each other and more compassionate.
I'm going to have a word of HR on Monday. one of the things I'd like to that was a joke, by the way, in case anyone from HR is listening. One of the things I'd like to pick up on is that sort of social awkwardness as well, because I'm going to be open on the podcast. This is what it's all for, right? Someone I bumped into them at the gym the other day, and I said, "Oh, I haven't seen you here in a while. How's it going?" And he says, "Oh, yeah, my mum passed away before New Year's." And I thought, "Oh my god." Sorry, like I said, obviously, I said, "I'm sorry to hear that." And then I sort of ran out of ideas. Like, genuinely, I thought, I don't know what to say after "I'm sorry to hear that." So then, being in the gym, and I know this is, I feel terrible saying this now, and I'm going to say it publicly, but you know, I said, "Oh, well, have a good session, and I'll catch up with you soon." I don't know what to say. Like, because, my thought process was, you know, sometimes I've seen people say, "So, you know, how was it? Was it a nice death, or, you know, was it, you know?" But then again, I don't know him that well to feel like I can have that level of conversation. So then I don't know what option two is. Like, option two is sort of try and nip it in the bud, I guess. So, like, you can see, even having this conversation, we're about 28 minutes into this conversation right now, and it's only now that I feel like I'm warming up to the idea of having an open, frank conversation about grief. This is really, really stifling as a concept, right? Yeah. So if you could be on my shoulder during that interaction, what would you advise me to navigate that better socially? And no pressure, by the way, you know, I'm not asking you to get it absolutely right, but just, I feel like I got it wrong. So how could I have gotten that better?
I love your question, because I think that's exactly why we live in an awkward society, because this is we don't like to feel shame, embarrassment. We usually, more often than not, we don't like to upset somebody. So I guess, do you know, it kind of comes back to emotional intelligence and like your social skills within that. So it's very difficult, but you need to read the room, right? And every person is different. So what you described there is so normal, and I bet listeners can resonate with that. You probably thought, "God, why did I ask?" Right? It's so normal, because it's uncomfortable, and now you're like, "God, I don't want to make it awkward." So, I guess, although it can be challenging, and we need to normalize that feeling that you described, acknowledging grief and offering support are generally always appreciated, because the person who's telling you that they lost someone, they also know it's going to make you feel uncomfortable, right? And they also usually, more often than not, they don't have any expectations because they're probably not even made sense of it all, right? So, but I think it's about reading the room. Is the person willing to say more? Do you know, then you ask more question. If not, you just say exactly how it is. Like, I think there needs to be an element of the authenticity and honesty, because in the end of the day, if you genuinely care and that comes across, that's going to be appreciated. And acknowledging someone's grief kind of involves recognizing their pain and their loss. And you did that, right? You said, gosh, I'm so sorry. And you know, yeah, I mean, what else can you say? And I think this recognition can be comforting to the person grieving, as it kind of validates their feelings as well and the significance of their loss, right? So even your shock reaction is just like, yeah, gosh, like it is tough what I've just gone through. Like, it's fine. You don't need to like hide that. Again, like, we need to normalize that's pretty bad what happened, right? So, and because grief doesn't have a fixed timeline, while the initial phase, for example, of that loss often brings in kind of outpouring of support, and that kind of dwindles over time, right? As soon as a funeral hits, people kind of just leave you to it.
Yes.
Like, well, back to normal. So then obviously the person who is quite deeply if affected by that loss is might feel even more isolated, might think nobody cares, and a lot of other things. So they might feel angry and resentment. And again, I think it's just important to not misread that or misjudge that as hostility. It's just, again, their stage of anger, right? They're going through that. So I think even reaching out months later can be especially meaningful. So, for example, that person in the gym, if you're close to them, it'd be lovely if you sent them a message in a couple of weeks, in a month, whenever it pops into your head, right? Like, I hope you're doing okay. You know, and because they just don't want to feel like it's forgotten, because they're still living with the pain. And it shows that the person that they've lost is also not forgotten, and that their ongoing process of grieving is kind of recognized and also respected. So there's definite value of offering support and empathy to those that are grieving. I can't give you a perfect script because I think it again depends on the person, the situation. And I think in the gym, like you said, even if it felt awkward to you, what else can you say, right? He's there to work out. So I think you handled it well. And it's just about that discomfort and how close the person is to you. Definitely reach out. If a person is close to you and they've lost somebody, you know, make sure you kind of remember important days, their birthdays, you know, the mother's birthday, or the day of their passing, or their birthday, right? Like, it might be really all those things might be difficult, because it's those occasions that will really kind of make you realize that the other person's not there anymore. So I think people just appreciate knowing that others remember and care, and acknowledging, like I said, those key dates, for example, that's meaningful. So yeah, I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Because, you know, that is something that is, it's bothered me a little bit. Throughout the rest of the session, I just thought, oh, I should do better at that. You know, being able to, like, I want to be able to feel confident in having those discussions. And I guess to your point, actually, you know, reading the room, not every room is going to be one that makes you feel confident, right? Like you said, we're actually in a gym. So I was midway through a workout, and it was, generally speaking, my interactions with people in the gym is very much, how's it going? Good session. See you soon. They are
Of
very,
course.
you know, to the point. So to stop and actually be confronted with a real life situation that feels way more important than any workout I've got is like, okay, you know, it caught me off guard. So it's very, very interesting that, you know, we're having this discussion, and you've given some pointers there, and you've actually answered a few of the next questions I had in terms of, you know, do you bring up key dates? Do you not? Because for me, I have a little bit of a weird memory for dates. I remember, okay, this happened at this time and that happened at that time. So, well, right now I do anyway. So that is, sometimes I feel, I'll tell you what, I'll be honest. I try and reach out on dates that I think are important, but I tell you, if I'm really honest to the listeners, I find it a lot easier if I reach out on my phone than in person. Because that
That's fine.
asynchronicity of being able to say, all right, I'll send a message and then I'll keep myself busy, and then they can either respond or not, rather than having to put it right directly in front of their face and then, you know, look in their eyes and let them feel like they have to respond. So sometimes, you know, ways of delivering that message can make it a little bit easier for both parties, I imagine.
Absolutely. And I think that just shows your level of empathy there, right? Like, that person might be in the middle of something, or they might actually be in a very happy space right now, and then your message would completely throw them, or they might not be wanting to talk about that right now, but I think they will always appreciate that somebody still cares and remembers. So I think when it comes to you naturally, just show it. We thrive of connection. We need to like feel like we belong. So us human beings need to feel like we loved or we are cared for. And I think you're doing absolutely the right thing. And again, like the person can, let's say you have a conversation with someone and you're trying to find out how they're doing. And they can say to you, do you know what? I just rather not talk about it right now. And you're like, okay, no problem at all. Well, if you ever want to talk about it, I'm here, right? Or vice versa. Like, you know, like I feel really uncomfortable. I don't want to keep reminding you of it, but I know it's on your mind anyway. So if you do want to talk, I'm here. Like, just, you know, just say it.
Be
like,
really open.
Don't make it. Yeah, I think so. I think it's better. And again, I appreciate actually, again, the fact that culturally, stereotypically with genders, like we're not always encouraged to talk and show emotions in certain ways, but let's break the damn stigma. It's not, you know, sorry, not swearing here, but
that's fine. That's fine. Go for it.
I know. You know, it's we're human beings. And I think we just need to normalize. It doesn't mean we're not feeling it just because we're not talking about it. So, and we can just be very honest. Like, I just want you to know, I've not forgotten. And again, if somebody just messages you on their birthdays and says, oh, you know, I hope you're having a birthday, it can be just equally annoying, right, for the other person. Yeah. It's like, just check in on them when they come into your mind or not. Or when you see them, say, I'm so sorry I haven't checked in on you, but I just, you know, I'm sometimes don't want to remind you of it. I know it's, I don't know, but yeah, just have these honest conversations. I think it's really important.
And you know, I think we're in a very interesting period of the year as well, because this first quarter of the year is loaded with so many occasions. So you've just come from Christmas, you've just come from New Year, then I think Valentine's Day hits, then you've got things like Mother's Day, then middle of the year, you've got Father's Day, and those two particular days, I've seen a few brands be forward thinking with those and send emails in advance and say, look, if you'd rather not get any sort of Mother's Day communications, just tick this box and we'll take you off this sort of thing, because you know that is really, really important, that if people don't want to be reminded or don't want people to assume they have a parent that is, you know, alive, then at least they can have the option. And I think that's really important for brands and individuals to be forward thinking. And I guess not assume anyone has access to anything. And again, lean on empathy when you can. So thanks, Katie, for bringing those things to the forefront. The next concept I wanted to talk about is sort of borrowing grief from the future. And I'm saying this from a real, real personal point of view, I suppose, because I often find myself, you know, if I see, I don't know, insert singer here who's the same age as one of my parents, I think, oh, but that's like my mum's age, or that's my dad's age, like, how, you know, how must I feel? And then I start going into some spiral about how I'd feel if they passed away, and, you know, all these sorts of conversations. I'm thinking, then, like, you know, a day later, I'm thinking, relax, you know, relax, they're still here, enjoy, you know, enjoy those moments with them. But then I think to myself, like, that's a phenomenon. Like, I can't be the only one that borrows grief from the future. Or if I see someone who one of their friends passed away, I think, oh my God, that is so, because it's so close to home in some ways, you start extrapolating across your whole network and I get a little bit nervous sometimes, you know what I mean? So, I mean, yeah, I guess what I'm asking for is reassurance that isn't a unique phenomenon to me and that people do it all the time.
Absolutely. And what you're talking about, worrying about future losses or grieving over an expected loss, is known as something called anticipatory grief. I hope I'm saying it right, actually. Probably people can tell now I'm not English, but anticipatory grief. So you're anticipating something that's something, it's a natural emotion, but of course that can cause significant anxiety, right? And if you think about anxiety, it's about usually about worrying things that haven't happened yet, right? That you anticipate in the future. And again, it's a very natural thing. Some people obviously do it to an unhealthy extent, some more on, at a different level, but we all do it. And it's, I guess it's that false thinking of, if we do it, we're preparing ourselves for something. But I guess the sad reality is that you're not, because it might never happen how you think. With death, of course, at one point it will happen. But whenever it happens, you'll have to deal with it anyway, right? And you are not preparing yourself, because the emotion that you feel then will still be very present and real then. So what you're doing is you're just draining your current energy for something that hasn't happened yet or might never happen or whatever. So I guess this type of grief, for example, is not limited to the anticipation of death, right? It can also encompass other types, like anticipated decline of someone's health, like you said, or just the reality of my parents are getting older, right? Or the ending of a relationship or the loss of a job, like we said earlier. So anticipated grief can involve a wide range of emotions, again, similar to those experienced in the traditional grief cycle that we spoke about. So sadness and anxiety, helplessness, all of those things, and fear, right? So people may grieve for the anticipated loss of that companionship, for the future plans that won't be realized, or for the changes in their life. So worrying about these future losses can lead to this excessive thing called ruminations. So the person repeatedly thinks about potential future scenarios and the implications of those. And then that can cause significant stress and anxiety. And then, of course, stress and anxiety can impact your daily functioning and, of course, your mental well-being, especially if it goes on for prolonged. So it is common to feel these conflicting emotions during that thing and during anticipated grief, and when you were differently triggered, like they say, somebody else loses someone, that might trigger that for you even more. But yeah, on a positive note, I like to say actually that anticipatory grief can also sometimes provide an opportunity for people to prepare emotionally for the loss, to make the most of their remaining time with the loved one. So you can't sometimes prepare yourself. It drains your current energy, but it can put things into perspective for you. So it can be a time for kind of resolving unfinished business, saying goodbye, or you mentioned in the beginning, he might think about reconciling with the person, right? And expressing love and forgiveness, which is beautiful because, like I said, we thrive for belonging and human connection. So yeah, it can in a strange way also benefit us in being more appreciative of what we have. So yeah, you might take more time with family and friends and all those things. So that's lovely. That's a good thing.
I really appreciate that one because, I phrased it like borrowing grief from the future, but your answer basically told me that you're not borrowing anything. You're duplicating. So don't do it. Don't spend that time doing something you're already going to do in future. Rather spend that time, boosting your current feelings around the future. Spend that time with that person instead. Give them a call, send them a text. That is really,
Absolutely.
really, that is
We won't
eye-opening.
get
Thank
the
you.
moment again.
Exactly.
Oh,
Exactly.
good.
Right. So, final two questions from me. Is there any culture in the world that you can think of, and again, I'm asking you to think off the top of your head, so no worries if not, that does grief really well?
Ooh, now you're putting me on the spot geographically. I think the cultures that are generally a little bit more open to meditation, life, meaning of life, like in Buddhism, for example, or South American cultures where it's celebrated in a way. So I think as much as you grieve the loss of someone, it's about celebrating the life that they had, right? And the time that you had with them. So you won't find any gratitude or any nice feelings in grief. And I guess those cultures that are more open to them, they understand that part, I guess. So they understand that, yeah, we're not grateful that we lost a person. And now, like, what is there to be grateful for, right? Like, it's just painful. But the time that you had, the opportunity you had to have that person as a sibling, as a sister, as a grandparent, as a parent, as a child, that is beautiful. And to be able to kind of shift your perspective, that helps you be grateful for that, to have had that opportunity, to have had those memories. So I think, yeah, sorry not to give you a direct answer exactly the cultures, because I don't want to get it wrong, but there are certainly, they're not very Western, maybe, but yeah, they're more open about the concept of life, and the philosophy around it is very different. So
So I think I'm going to give a reflection and then I'm going to ask you for 3 to 5 tips on grief.
okay.
But my reflection is, I think I started this episode with the hope or the vision that we would leave with some sort of good grief. And I'm laughing to myself because actually on reflection, obviously that was never going to happen, right? But the idea that, I'd leave this episode feeling content with any grief I might face in my life. Reality is, those same nerves, anticipatory grief, that still exists and that still probably will exist, although to a better extent, and I may leverage it in a more positive way. And I probably will, and listeners probably will experience those 5 stages of grief at some point in their life. However, hopefully, as a result of this conversation, we're more familiar with the concept, we're more able to tune in with our own emotions, and we're more able to navigate that circumstance with authenticity, more compassion for ourselves and others, and more empathy. So, despite not leaving this conversation with good grief, I think, thankfully, we've left it better than we found it. So thank you very much, Katie, for your contribution to this amazing discussion. Before our friends die, we got the grief conversation in the bag. Thank you very much.
I'm so glad to hear that. Thank you so much. It's been an honor talking to you. And obviously, it's a very, very, very important topic. And I just think it's beautiful that you made space for this.
Thank you. So your top tips, what are they in dealing with grief?
I think the way, sorry, so I exhaled because I guess it's in short, I love the phrase, there is no healing without feeling, right? So we talked about how personal grief is. It's a highly personal process, and what works for one person may not work for another. So I think there are generically some strategies of coping that can help. So firstly, recognizing that grief is a natural response to loss. So allowing yourself to feel and express your emotions without any judgments, whether it's sadness, anger, confusion, anything that might feel uncomfortable, it still has its function. And then I guess by naming that, by recognizing that, that type of awareness puts you way more in control than being consumed by that emotion and being controlled by it. So, and also emotions are a fleeting thing. They don't always last, you know, it's something that we need to remember. And that's why sometimes when we even feel happiness again, after we lost somebody, we feel guilty, right? Because we think we're supposed to feel differently. But that goes back to my saying about the judgment piece, be compassionate with yourself. So I think there's an element of recognizing it. There's an element of self-compassion or compassion for you, for the people around you. It's about leaning on support of friends and family. Don't think that even though it feels like nobody can feel what you're feeling, as human beings, we can even imagine how it might be, or we might have gone through it ourselves. So you're not alone with it. So it's important to lean on people. And if it is unbearable, seek out professional help. You know, I'm always an advocate for that. I think you don't always have to wait till things are really, really bad. If you feel like you need a neutral pace or professional person to speak to, just 100%, I would always encourage that. And I guess another coping thing could be engaging in certain rituals, right? Like whatever makes you kind of happy, whether it's lighting a candle, going to the grave, or going for a walk, or celebrating the birthday of the deceased person. Whatever gives you comfort, I think, and feels you can, makes you feel connected is really important as well. And it might be challenging sometimes to try to maintain your regular routine, and it shouldn't be a chore. Just anything that helps and makes you feel good, really, you should do. But keeping up with daily tasks and providing a little bit of structure and a sense of normality also helps, because obviously you feel a bit lost because it's so overwhelming sometimes, right? And it can be physically draining. So again, like basic things, but they're easily overlooked, like eating healthy, getting enough sleep, physical activity, all of those things really, really help in that structure. And I'm a massive advocate for self-care practices. So again, with that, I don't mean this idea of, you know, be selfish. It just means like make sure you refill your cup. So whatever feels good to you, whether it's a hobby, whether it's having a bath, right? Like it's not just chocolate and bubble bath, but if that makes you feel good, that can be that as well, right? But if it's meditation, do that. If it's yoga, do that. If it's deep breathing exercise, a very powerful breathing, again, something we overlook quite a lot, but it all helps with reducing stress and anxiety that is associated with grief. So again, I would say whatever floats your unique boat, really, and makes you feel good, try that. And I guess it makes me sound very mumsy here, but try to avoid relying on things that just numb your pain. Mm. So although it's nice to kind of drink it away or do drugs or whatever, they are unhealthy coping mechanisms and they're only temporary relief. So they will then obviously lead to addiction, all of the other things, because it's an unhelpful coping mechanism. So you have to find more creative outlets. You know, you can journal, you can write, you can even write letters to the disease, right? So often you might find closure in that way, right? You can, these things I wish I could have told you, or I wish I could have asked you, or I imagine you would have said this now to this stage of my life, like write, you know, or speak to them if you don't want to write, like whatever. We have so many things at our disposal, like do it whichever way works, but an outlet, something creative that can help you.
I love that,
And
get more creative, because I remember hearing maybe 10 years ago a speaker spoke about we all have noisy minds, we really want a clear mind, but if we can't reach a clear mind, we'll cloud our minds with substances. So it's always made me reflect on the substances,
powerful.
that I'm taking. And then I think to myself, okay, what else can I do? But your message there about get more creative is a really cool challenge, actually, because you're almost challenging yourself to not just, take what we know works. If we're celebrating, we drink alcohol. If we're commiserating, we drink alcohol. Alcohol is just there. It's been planted there for whatever occasion, anytime. But your challenge of get more creative, I think, is something I'm going to take away from this episode as well. Always challenge myself to get more creative when I'm
Love it.
eating a bit. I was about to go downstairs and eat some chocolate, but I might get more creative and, I don't know, do some breathing.
Yeah, or start with chocolate raisins or whatever, I'm not saying
Start
deny yourself
easy.
things. Yeah, it's about realizing that it's a process, like habits, we are natures of habit, but it's also very difficult to make something your habit. So it takes time, and I think you should start very small, right? So if you fancy that bar of chocolate or that glass of wine, I'm not saying don't do it. Of course, do it, but don't let that be your go-to, your coping mechanism. Do the healthy things as well, right? Because the more you deny yourself, the more you're draining your willpower, I suppose. So that can backfire as well. But yeah, I think you get the message though. Yeah, creativity is beautiful. And we all have that, like we all have that. We just kind of let it rest because we kind of go into autopilot and functioning. So it's very, very important to kind of go into that and just try different things. Music is a fantastic outlet as well. Listening it, intensifying your emotions or relieving certain, like that's my go-to anyway. So yeah, I think whatever works for you though, and it's really beautiful, and yeah, just focus on the things that you can control basically.
Thank you so much. And with that being said, that has been Before Our Friends Die. You've been joined by me, Kavan, and this is the Aki and Saltfish Digital Network. Now, Dr. Katie, if you would, please share any social media you've got. People would love to follow you, I'm sure, or I could put it down below in the description so that people can click on the links and go straight there.
Sure.
Positive psychology for life.
Love to connect.
Thank you very much. So thank you very much, Katie. It's been incredible having this conversation with you. And that is genuinely a bucket list type conversation. So I'm so glad we had it. Thank you very much. And don't forget, you can email akiandsaltfish@gmail.com if you've got any questions or comments. Please leave us a 5-star rating and review, because it really helps us grow with those things called algorithms. And don't forget to listen, comment, subscribe, share. All those amazing things are available on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Amazon Podcasts. Anywhere you find your podcast, we are there, I promise you. Thank you very, very much. Take care and stay tuned for part 2 next week. Bye-bye.